Hello and welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the latest episode of the Footmarks podcast on Combox, where the game lives on. I'm Behram Kazi, who you can find at Def Mango on Twitter, and with me is Jared Kimber, who you can find absolutely everywhere. Jared, Australia have defeated England in the final test of the Ashes. The scoreline ends up being 4-1. It was a very comfortable 5-wicket win at the SCG for the home side. And I mean, England prepared quite a lot for this series. In fact, Baz McCullum said they were overprepared, and Australia were the team with all the problems. Josh Hazlewood never featured. Cummins featured in a solitary test in which he couldn't crank it up at all. Nathan Lyon got injured midway as well after playing two test matches. Travis Head was the opener. Usman Khawaja never opened and is now retired. Have I missed anything?
No, I think that makes a lot of sense. I mean, it is worth saying that by the last test match, if you were to look at England's frontline bowling lineup, it was almost not there at all.
Yep. And you know that meme where, you know, it's the Simpsons and someone saying, stop it, he's already dead. That's kind of what I felt like, you know, watching the last
test match. I think I tweeted that when Head was dropped in this test match.
Well, there you have it, right? And England just kept dropping catches, right? I probably don't have as many fingers and toes combined as many catches as they dropped in this series. I remember 5 in the second test match at the Gabba. There were 3.
I think it was 5 in 1 day, wasn't it?
Yeah, there were 5 in a day. 3 at the Adelaide Oval, and I reckon 6 in this game, if I'm not wrong. And then a couple more catches dropped here and there. As you said, it's like they had pins in their hands or the ball had pins on it. This was bad. And it's even a worse look when you consider how they did not have a fielding coach on tour.
I mean, we've been saying for a while that there's definitely an issue with England and their preparation when it comes to catching and whether they take it as seriously as they should and everything else. So, yes, I think that played a part. We actually have the stats. I think it was 43. Wait a minute. I've got it here because I saw Rob was... Oh, here we go. Yeah. Himinesh put it up. This is before the end. So I know they dropped one more. They dropped Marnus that I'm aware of. There might have been another one I've forgotten. But Australia caught 62 and dropped 7. And England caught 42 and dropped 12.
Wow.
Well, so that's 13 at least because... So yeah, it's bad. It's not good.
Yeah. I mean, look, they lost the advantage in a couple of those test matches just because they dropped all those catches. And I mean, if you spend the fielding coach budget on a holiday to Noosa, I suppose people will come out with their pitchforks, right? And that ultimately ends up being a big talking point, although this is something pretty standard with the baseball team. They did this in India. They went to the UAE in between test matches, remember?
Yeah, I mean, the holiday thing I'm less interested in, but the catching thing I am, because when they first started dropping catches under McCullum was like, everyone was like, we've noticed you are not doing as much catching practice, right? A lot of those, it was quite noticeable to me as a guy who follows all the teams in the world that England had started doing less fielding than any other side, right? And McCullum was like, these guys know how to catch, they know how to field, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, okay, well, they're still as shit a fielding side as they were when you took over. And I would argue, I don't have the numbers to hand, but I think you make a pretty good argument they might be a worse fielding side.
True.
Than when they took over, right? Than when he took over. So if that's the case, that's on him, right? And absolutely. If you don't have a fielding coach and you guys don't believe that you need a fielding coach, you need to do as much work as everyone else, well, maybe you do, right? Maybe. And I think, again, you have to be close to perfect to beat Australia in Australia, right?
Yeah.
And when you drop that many catches, even if you were a slightly better side, I don't know how that comes out.
Yeah, I mean, maybe they were doing their fielding drills with golf balls. That's a theory that I have, at least. Also, the title of this episode is The Ashes of Bazball. That can be misleading, perhaps. Some people might feel like they won it just reading the title. But, I mean...
They didn't. Spoiler alert.
Ashes... Oh, well, Bazball really was turned to ashes in a way because Travball thumped Bazball, right? Like, Australia batted faster for the vast majority of the series compared to England.
I think I think they scored faster than England, didn't they, in the series? I'd have to look at the runs per over, but the last time I looked, they had scored quicker in the series, and I don't think there's any reason for that to have changed.
And England kind of lost the ethos midway through this Ashes series, and they started blocking. It was block ball, not baz ball. And then they came back and won a test match by baz balling, which was kind of refreshing. And Zach Rawley mentioned that it would be a good series if, you know, they end up with a 3-2 scoreline. But let's be real, this Ashes was dead and buried after the third test. Like 3-0 done. No one cares anymore. I barely watched the last two test matches.
it definitely lost a lot of steam towards the end. And of course, the fact that Australia at that stage weren't going to have three of their best four bowlers, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, no matter how you look at it, it was gone by that point. So that probably flatters England. I mean, the other way of looking at this is that England, if we take away Brisbane and Adelaide, England probably still think that if that Perth test is played a bunch of times, they have a chance of winning that particular match, right?
Yep.
And they had a chance of winning this one as well. So they might be looking at it going, there was a couple of 50-50 games and we were on the bad side of them. And then one 50-50 game we were on the right side of. Mm. That's probably the most optimistic way you can look at how England went in this series. And I was thinking that, you know, when Marnus was dropped, if he gets caught then, and Australia, I thought Australia were really handling that chase in Sydney very poorly, right? Mm. And let's say England somehow manages to steal that game. Like 3-2, it doesn't mean anything at that point, right? Yeah. Like, so I picked 3-2 before the series. Mm. And like a lot of people would have messaged me going, oh, well done, you said 3-2 and it was 3-2. And I was thinking to myself, it doesn't mean anything because this is a 4-1 series. That's kind of how it should have been in the end, because Australia was better at fielding and batting and bowling all the way through. But perhaps just because Australia panicked in a chase and, you know, didn't handle the England very well in that game at Melbourne meant that, it, you know, but it could have been 5-0, right? But 4-1 probably feels more right than 5-0, I think.
I feel like if had the Australians not partied too hard over Christmas, it could have been 5-0, right? Like it was definitely on. And it does mean something.
I don't
know,
man. I think, honestly, once the... You're asking the reserve players to do a lot of work, and then you had a bit of a wicket that, you know, both teams could go in either way.
Yeah.
Right? So, I mean, I get what you're saying, but if it's for me, I think England, it would have been ridiculous if England had lost this 5-0. That's the way that I look at it. By the way, I've got that runs per over if you want.
Okay.
England at 3.89
Whoa.
And Australia at 4.25. So Australia kept them under 4 runs and over.
England basically didn't baz ball apart from those two-day test matches, right? Those were the only games in which they somewhat kind of brought that sort of game out or approach out. Yeah.
They used little bits of baz ball, to be fair to them, right? But they didn't really baz ball. They tried to do baz ball with brains, but unfortunately, they don't have the talent to be able to pull that off at the moment. And on top of that, they're not as skillful as the Australian players or as wise as the Australian players.
Yeah, it often comes down to skill, but you mentioned how Australia batted better, they bowled better and they fielded better. I would say the decision-making was also better. Yeah. And, you know, England was the in-form batting team when we previewed the series. We said that, hey, I mean, I gave them 2-2, right? And it could have been or could have gone down that direction had they won the Perth Test. And you mentioned how England need the chaos. They require the chaos to pull off a result. And those are the two test matches, one that they won at the MCG, and then the first one at Perth, which they really should have won, at least at the end of day's play on day one. It felt like England had that one in the bucket. In fact, at lunch on day two,
yeah.
That's where they were, 80 for one effectively? Something like that, right? And then they just completely tank it. And I feel like there's obviously going to be a lot of frustration. Everyone was looking forward to the series. The England contingent made everything about the Ashes. Of course, they retired Jimmy Anderson for the Ashes. And we also spoke about Shoaib Bashir, who never got a game, who the only contribution that he probably had was when he took the pictures that he took of what, the Adelaide Oval, the surface, right? That's the only time he featured at all. And, you know, we've mentioned quite a few times on Combox now that they just probably couldn't understand that conditions in Australia had changed. The surfaces were grassy. You know, everyone was bowling the wobble seam ball and you retired Jimmy Anderson. And then, of course, the reinforced seam on the Kookaburra ball with plastic. All of these things counted. And they picked a bowling attack for like a test series in Australia like 7 years ago, not current Australia. And that's where they ultimately faltered. And they couldn't even retain the same bowling attack. Like, they kept losing their fast bowlers one test after another. Mark Wood, initially. Then you had Jofra Archer, Gus Atkinson, and eventually Ben Stokes in the final game.
Yeah. I mean, I think we have to remember that, but it doesn't really matter because their bowling lineup, when it was fit, wasn't as good as Australia's, right? Mm. And Australia had Doggett and Nisa and still looked like they had a better bowling lineup. And I think maybe the best story of the whole thing is the breakdown of Matt Potts. Mm. I think that tells you as much as you need to know about the current English side is, instead of just letting Matt Potts come in and bowl like Matt Potts, it was quite clear that there was some kind of other advice that he was given, because I've never seen him bowl like that before, right? I've never seen him not attack off stump. That's what he does. Mm. And yet he was bowling shorter. He was bowling wider than I've ever seen before. And he had a complete breakdown. And if you look at the two warm-up games, he was going at like 2.5 and 3 runs and over. So it wasn't happening in the warm-up games. He was bowling normally in the warm-up games. And so you look at this, and the amount of times I've said this during the series of their bowling plans were absolutely baffling to someone like me who keeps the data. Like, it was so weird the whole way through. They were bowling too short. They were bowling too wide. I never really understood it. And you know, to go back to what you said before, Bolam showed them what to do before and after lunch on the second day of this series. Hmm. So to really, that's such, for me, it's the most crucial part of this entire series. Bolam bowls a great spell. And I remember me and Shyam, it was the day I had the literary festival. So Cheyenne had come over and we were watching it in the room, and then we did the show and we were like, both like, Bolam bowled great before this spell, before lunch here. And I don't think they got a wicket at all. I think Duckett and Pope both survived that spell. So I don't, Pope somehow survived it and Duckett did okay. And we were saying they probably should have got a wicket from that spell and they haven't. And then after lunch, I was saying on that show, England just need to get through Boland, right? And if he's going to bowl again, he's not going to bowl that much because he's just bowled now. If they can get through Boland, this is their test match. Mm. And I mean, all Boland did was bowl on the spot or in the shoebox, right?
Yep.
Moving the ball both ways. And he gets, what, 3 wickets in a couple of overs and it's over. The series is over at that point because by the time Head comes out, it's a completely different game. Right. And look at the difference. Bolam bowled the ball on the right spot, getting seam movement in both directions, and England come out and try 10 different things against Head.
Yeah.
There is only one idea against Head. You bowl just above off stump consistently over and over again, and he plays stupid shots.
Yeah. Throw in the odd Yorker as well, because sometimes he falls to it. But like, when you speak of the bowling plans, they really were baffling. I mean, I don't understand how these guys are professional, you know, athletes, and they play cricket for a living, and they couldn't understand that short and wide is not the way forward. You've literally got, as you mentioned, Scotty Boland and the other team, who only does one thing. He gets the ball to nip around off a length and he doesn't miss his mark. And he's ended up taking, what, 20 wickets at 25 apiece in this series? Compare that to England's highest wicket taker, who is weirdly the second highest wicket taker of the Ashes because he plays all 5 tests. Bryden Carr, 22 wickets at 30 apiece. Bowled absolute arse. We know that he wasn't good. Right?
But it's the runs per over, I think, is the biggest difference between those two, right?
Yeah.
You know, there were times in this series where Carr is going at 6 runs and over, and it's just like, and Boland's ended up being the most economical of the two. But here's one for you. We've just watched this series. Does it not look like this is a team who just got rid of several senior members of their analysis team and who doesn't have a fielding coach? If you didn't know those two things, if you're just a casual Ashes English fan, wouldn't you be asking yourself, why are we consistently not coming up with good ideas, and why are we why are we dropping all these catches? Like, that's a McCullum thing, that's a Stokes thing, right? That's a Rob Key thing. That's that leadership group has made this decision, and they looked like a dumb team who couldn't catch. Mm. That's what they looked like, and Australia looked like a smart team who could catch.
And Australia
didn't even play that well in this Ashes.
Exactly. Like, Australia was the team which had all the problems. Oh, by the way, we spoke about how Hazelwood never featured. Cummins played 1 test on one leg. Lyon got injured after 2 test matches and technically 3 because he didn't play one. Usman Khawaja never opened. Travis Head opened throughout. Steve Smith didn't play a test match in between. We forgot that one because I knew that.
I don't think, how many runs did Steve Smith make in this series? Like 260, 300 was it?
I mean, that ton helped, which, I mean, they gifted to him because they dropped the catch when he was on 12.
Yeah, I don't Yeah, I don't think he makes a lot of runs in this series. He ended up with a good record. Don't get me wrong. It's very important that we mention that. I'm not saying he didn't make any runs, but what I am saying is he didn't really have a big impact on this series in the way that he has over the last couple of years. So I'm just having a look here at the top run scorers. Yeah, he's not in the top three. So where has he ended up? Most runs. He ended up with 286 runs, an average of 57. Right? That's not a lot of runs. It's a good record.
Yeah.
Right? But it's not a lot of runs.
And so if you take the ton out, then it's not a lot of runs at all, because he ends up scoring 138 in that innings, and that's half his runs, or more than half his runs. So that's something for you. And, you know, he might not have had some sort of an impact that he usually has on Ashes series, whether they are home and away, but some of the Australians did. Before we talk about them, let us take a short break. You guys are watching Footmarks with Jared and Behram, and go nowhere, because we will be back in like half a minute.
Cricket boards actually make watching their games almost impossible now. I spend almost as much time trying to find where I can view it as I do actually following the action. That is why I use NordVPN. They let me find all the cricket I want to watch while protecting me from the nasty side of the internet. Nord will free your cricket matches. Grab your exclusive NordVPN deal by going to nordvpn.com/goodareas to get a huge discount off your NordVPN plan plus 4 additional months on top. It's completely risk-free with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. Watch every match with NordVPN.
Welcome back to the Footmarks podcast. You guys are with Jared and Behram, and we are doing an autopsy of the recently concluded Ashes series, which Australia managed to win 4-1. You mentioned, Jared, that England ultimately looked like a team which didn't have, you know, a lot of elite analysts on board and a fielding coach. Well, one Australian stole the show in this Ashes series. He took 31 wickets at less than 20 apiece. It was in many ways a Mitchell Stark Ashes, because he also scores back-to-back half centuries for the first time in his career. But like, surely in the first two test matches, there should have been one person in that England dressing room which would have suggested that, hey, maybe let's save our attacking shots for the rest, you know, Doggett and maybe even Boland and someone else, and let's not try to take Mitchell Stark down. They kept edging out to him. You know that he takes first over wickets, and you were like, let's add to that tally. Let's give him like 3 to 4 more. And full credit to Stark, because his average speed in this series was 142 clicks, which for a guy who's nearly 36 years of age is insane. And he's also had the best ever year ever in Test cricket in 2025, where he's taken his wickets at 17 apiece and he's taken 55 of them. So this is a guy who's upskilled, who has the swing still, but when that's not working, he goes to the wobble ball. He's smarter than ever. He's better than ever. But England really hand this Ashes on a plate to Mitchell Stark, and that's somewhat on them as well.
Yes, it is. I think they thought they were playing in a series against the old Mitchell Stark. I really think they hadn't quite fully understood that this was a different, more rounded bowler than before. Again, I don't know if that's analysts or if it's just the players not taking him as seriously or whatever it may be, but I don't think they really understood that. There were elements of this in the 23 Ashes, but I think it's between the 23 Ashes and now that he's become this new bowler, right? Without losing any of his pace, as you said, which is also remarkable. We put a piece up on the main channel, and you know, you and I might do a podcast on it, or someone in Combox will do a podcast on it soon. But I think what's incredible is that we are seeing this more rounded bowler, and I don't think England had really kind of put that in their thoughts as much. And it was an incredible series. It wasn't just the wickets, of course. It was also the runs, a couple of important knocks that he had all the way through. And so it's a huge, huge series where he has put the team on his back. But it's not like Jasper Bumrah's series of recent times, right? Like you know, we've seen other series that are more dominant than this, but it allowed for Australia to basically bring him back on whenever they needed him to, without the old Stark going for runs.
Yeah.
There were none of those terrible run spells. Doggett bowled some of the bouncer overs. Cameron Green bowled some of the bouncer overs. So they didn't need to use him for that stuff. And he just bowled line and length. I mean, he is now a line and length bowler. And he wasn't a line and length bowler for a decade before this, right? Like and I don't think England were quite ready for that. He had a better line and length than most of the England bowlers in this series.
I think another thing that England didn't think through was that, you know, what if we lose Mark Wood and Jofra? Who's going to take the new ball? Oh, surely it's Brydon Cass, the guy who doesn't do it at county level, right? Like, what is going on?
Yeah, and everyone's been saying, like, oh, Josh Tung has to take the new ball. And it's like, there's a reason they're not giving it to him as well. Mm. For the same reason they didn't want to give it to Cass. It's because neither of these guys are new ball bowlers. And, you know, and having someone like Stark, this is the difference between Stark, especially this Stark, and but even if you go back, the old Stark before he was at this level and as rounded as he is now, is that Stark can do the job of Cass and Tung, but also take the new ball.
Yeah.
So you get double bites of the cherry with Stark, whereas with those guys, they're really more older ball bowlers, right? Mm. And because of that, that was one of the big differences. It was an incredibly, like, I hope he gets the credit he deserves for this, because to be able to do this where you only have one other senior bowler available for the entire tournament, the entire series, the fact that he doesn't miss test matches anymore, as you said, everyone's fascinated on the speed, but it's speed, it's skill, it's resilience, it's professionalism, and then it's also knowing that you're going to have to come on and make an impact every time, where he doesn't have to do that when Cummins is in the side.
Yeah.
He doesn't have to do that when if he has a bad new ball spell and Hazelwood's in the side, it doesn't matter because no one's hitting Hazelwood at the other end, right?
Yeah.
And Cummins can come on first change. There was so much pressure on almost every spell that Stark had, right? Until Australia were, you know, massively up. But in game pressure, there was so much pressure because there were times where it looked like Boland and Stark had to do it all, and England wasn't too worried about the other bowlers, right? And so that's a lot of pressure on him that he's not used to, right? It's not that he doesn't have the talent or the ability to handle it, but he's not used to that because generally he's been the superfluous bowler, right? He's the one that can just do Mitchell Stark things and it doesn't matter. This series, it had to be the grown-up Mitchell Stark, and it was the best grown-up Mitchell Stark we've ever seen.
Yeah, I mean, he wasn't required to just go for those magic balls with the new ball. He switched things around. Like you said, he became a line and length bowler. And, you know, we're talking about one of the greatest fast bowling trios of all time. The other one that I can think of is probably what? Garner, Holding and Marshall. Did those three play together? Right?
Yeah.
Apart from those three, you're looking at Stark, Hazelwood, Cummins, right? I don't know. We'll have to do like a proper deep dive as to who is the better fast bowling trio.
Gillespie, Lee, and McGrath.
Stain, Philander, Morkel. That's another one.
There's a
Bolt, Saudi, Wagner.
Donald, Pollock, and Teamy. Ooh, is a pretty good one as well.
Really good one. No, look,
there's a few, but you're right. I mean, look, it's incredible. And also, it is actually more like the West Indies because there are four of them, right? Even if Scott Boland isn't quite the same kind of bowler, there's four of them available. And I suppose Pete, New Zealand and West Indies are probably a few of the teams who've ever had the four guys all at one stage, you know, absolutely, you know, smashing everyone. And so that's a very different kind of situation. I remember when I think Jason Gillespie's very underrated as a bowler. And I think the 050 Ashes, because it's such a famous Ashes and he was done by then, a lot of that rubs off on him and people forget how good he was. But when Jason Gillespie was the leader of the attack, there was a huge drop off. It didn't work for him at the international level when he was the leader of the attack, right? And so that's what Stark was here. And he hasn't needed to be the leader of the attack. They haven't even really had a leader of the attack, right? Because of the way of their bowling is. And suddenly he was, no matter how you looked at it, coming into this series, we didn't know if England would smack Boland around again like they had last time, right?
True.
And Doggett never bowled anywhere near his potential, right? So you've got, there's so many question marks over the Australian bowling attack. And for a while, it was Stark who was carrying them.
Yeah, I mean, in the first two test matches, Mitchell Stark had 18 wickets. He ends up with 31. And like, he's the leading wicket taker. I get it why they gave him the player of the series, because he does dismantle England in the first two test matches and scores valuable runs. But, you know, he did have that pressure on him because Cummins and Hazelwood weren't around. And prior to this Ashes series, if you had taken the entire Gooderias team and asked them to rate the trio in test cricket, with the red ball at least, Cummins, Hazelwood, Stark would probably be number three for a lot of those people. So he kind of smashes that notion, right? I love it. I love this late career renaissance and I love the resilience. And I mean, the physio said that he's a bit of a freak and I can totally see how, because the guy never gets injured. So
exactly. Yeah.
We mentioned how he's in his Walton Goggins era. The hairline is definitely doing its thing.
I forgot about the Walton Goggins era.
Yeah. You should definitely put that in a piece.
I don't think it was in the piece, actually. But yeah, it's it's going to be interesting to see what the next 2 years are. But I also do hope he gets I know a lot of people wanted Head to be player of the series. I could have made a pretty good case. You know, I don't care about these awards, but if you were asking me, I could make a pretty good case for Carey to be player of the series as well.
True.
So to me, it didn't matter, but I do think it's Stark's Ashes because it is on both sides of the ball.
Yeah.
And Australia win this series by being 3-0 up, right? Mm. And in those first three tests, he's remarkable.
Yeah, he loses a bit of steam by the end, but you'd expect that. I mean, the guy is almost 36 and he's playing 5 tests and he does that pretty much every summer. It's not like he does this, you know, it's not an anomaly, basically. It's this business as usual for him. It's interesting you bring up, you know, the other guys. Nisar is interesting. He became a cotton bowled machine and that's also on England to a certain extent. But Alex Carey, Adelaide Oval, he scores a ton and a 50. And he irks the Englishmen. There's a lot of snicko drama that's gone on in the Ashes as well. Even in the last test match, we saw some of it. But his keeping, you know, when he comes up to the stumps, it was also a big feature. There's so many heroes who perhaps wouldn't, you know, kind of run away with the limelight like Stark and Head have. But I feel like this was a coming of age for Alex Carey. It's been a while since he took that dip in the Karachi pool. But this last year, he averaged, what, north of 50 with the bat. He's been exceptional behind the stumps. I think he has a very solid shout on current form of being the best red ball wicketkeeper batter.
So the most important thing I think that happened in the series is Boland and at the Wacker. Sorry, at Perth. And I think the second most important thing is actually Carey at the Gabba. When he comes up to the stumps and they get the two caught and bowls, right? And they suddenly realize they can't do anything with Nisar and Boland other than huge risks, right? And the other thing with Carey that I would add to that is the fact that he has been a number seven his whole life. Australia were looking, you know, we've done a whole piece on Carey that I'm sure will turn into a footmarks as well.
Yeah.
But Australia have been looking at Inglis and trying to work out how to get Inglis in. And every time they did that, Carey got better.
Yeah.
And I know that they wanted a wicketkeeper who was good enough to bat in the top six. And they know Inglis is, and they didn't think Carey was. And Carey has kept getting better and better until now they're batting Carey in the top six.
Yeah.
Right? They're actually doing the thing that they never wanted to do before. And on top of that, he's not just batting in the top six. It's Cameron Green who's gone behind him in the batting order, right? Yeah,
that is insane.
Again, which tells you how shaky Australia's batting order has been, that Cameron Green is gone from being number three in the West Indies to being number seven in this series. But the fact that, as you said, you know, one of the best wicketkeeper batters in the world at the moment, I think I'd still take Rishabh Pant ahead of him, right? But transformatively, if he can bat at number six and can keep up the stumps and take away people using their feet like they do in modern test cricket, he's a more impactful cricketer than Rishabh Pant all round.
Yeah.
Right? And Rishabh Pant can still play innings that Alex Carey's never going to touch. And Rishabh Pant is a proper top order player. And Alex Carey may be able to moonlight there for 2 years during his peak. But that 2 years could be a really important 2 years period of Australian cricket, right?
Yeah.
And the fact that Inglis ends up being the specialist number seven in the side and Carey is batting ahead of him when it was Carey that they thought wasn't as good as Inglis for ages. I just think shows you just how much he has changed as a cricketer. But the bigger impact he had wasn't the batting. The bigger impact was once England couldn't use their feet to the Australians seamers anymore, that was almost the ball game right then and there because they just got stuck.
Yeah, I mean, when we started Footmarks, I remember you and I did a show on the Bazball Shuffle of how England's batters were consistently batting outside the crease and Carey takes that little bit of strategy out and he was exceptional keeping in front of the stumps and some of those takes were just unreal. And, you know, in comparison to Rishabh Pant, I'd also take Pant the batter because he's more dynamic, but Carey scores clutch runs. He's the better glovesman by quite a distance. So it's a very interesting conversation to have. And I suppose he in this series has just sent a spiritual memo to Stuart Broad that he'd be remembered for a lot more than that stumping, right?
Yeah, I think it's an important thing for him, I think, emotionally. I don't think he's too worried about the best, I think, if we're being honest. I've certainly never heard anything from behind the scenes of like, oh, it's ever bothered him or anything else. Yeah. But he'd been playing really good cricket over the last 18 months. I think it would have been disappointing for him if Australia had won this Ashes and he hadn't played a big part in it. Hmm. Whereas now you're saying, you know, I mean, we were covering this over and over again. We're basically saying that if you look at what Carey did and you look at what Stark did, it's very similar to what Mitchell Johnson and Brad Haddin did in 13-14, right?
Very true.
And so, you know, maybe the big difference is there's you know, Ryan Harris is maybe a little bit better than Scott Bolart. But you got a little bit of Travis Head. Like, that's the big, probably the big difference in all of this. Mm. And so it's a very similar series. And he deserves to be remembered as that guy. And Brad Haddin is basically, as an international cricketer, is largely remembered for that 13, you know, as, in a positive way, is largely remembered for that 13-14 Ashes. And I think that Carey has that now. And now it's up to him to see what he does over the next couple of years. He really is, as I said, you know, we'll get to this on the footmarks, but he didn't look like a guy who could make 100 for a long period of time.
Yeah.
And he's made 2 in year and a half, whenever it's been. Mm-hmm. He now looks like a guy who can bat at number 6, average 40 at number 6, which you would take. That's absolutely fine. And can be transformative with the gloves because he can do something that only him and Blundell have really shown the ability to do to genuinely hard bowlers to keep up with the stumps to.
Yeah, I mean, look, Scotty Boland can crank it up on occasion. And I know Nisa is slightly slower, but you look at his efficiency behind the stumps, especially when he's keeping up to the stumps. It's just unreal. I can't remember errors.
Did you see the Kimapa show that me and Robbie did about that?
Dude, I've been just recording podcasts on podcasts.
No, it's fine. That's why I was asking. So Nisa is the sort of guy that traditionally I think you can keep up to the stumps too, right? I think that Boland is not. And part of the reason with Boland is he hits the pitch a lot harder and he's, and the seam movement he gets and the way it hits your gloves. If you bat against Boland, what people have always told me is it feels like he's punching the bat. And that's exactly the same when you're keeping. So Nisa is the sort of person all you need to say to Nisa is, I'm coming up. And Nisa's going to slow down by 5Ks and you'll be fine. Mm. Boland's got bowling the exact same deliveries. Yeah. Right. I think he came, also, to be fair, I think he came up to Doggett as well at times.
Yes.
It really is remarkable. And Jamie Smith can't do that.
Mm. Well, Jamie Smith drops catches as well. Crucial ones at that. So, you know, the Travis Head drop, what was it? The Gabba test, was it? Can't remember now. They dropped so many.
Adelaide? Jared.
Yeah, it might have been Adelaide, actually. Yeah, Travis Head goes on to score some runs in that one. And as good as Carey has been, he wasn't the best South Australian to feature in this series. Perhaps that award goes to Travis Head. He's batting out of position as opener. They've done this before in Asia, never before in Australia. And he's probably now going to open for them in the future as well. Because, I mean, he smashed 629 runs in 10 innings at an average of 62.9. His strike rate was north of 87. Trav ball thumped Baz ball, as I said earlier. And he scored 12 test centuries now in his test career. 3 of them came in this series. So a quarter of his overall tally comes in this series. He was.
There aren't
a solid
many guys
candidate.
Who've ever made 300s in a Ashes series, are there? I don't think there's a huge number of those, despite the fact that they're longer series. Like there isn't a huge amount of those. So it's incredible. What I like about this is such a cricket nerd Jared Kimber thing. But what I like about this is the way that you should use your team.
Yeah.
You should be in a position to be like, he obviously is the world's best number 5, and we can move him back to number 5. Not world's best number 5, but one of the best number 5s in the world. And we can move him back to number 5 if we need to. But we also have the ability to use him in certain situations to open the batting. As long as they don't think that they have to use him at opening the batting forever from here on in, and that they have that flexibility again. I don't even mind if if they've got a lot of flexible batters. And it's a shame him and Usman aren't around. I would love the idea of him and Usman just swapping in the order depending on what the game situation is and everything else. I think that makes a lot of sense. They're not going to do that and that, you know, things are going to change quite dramatically and we'll see what happens next. But this is how you should use your batting order, right? He came up for the right reason. He didn't come up just because Usman was injured, because Marnus had done that in the first innings. Mm. He came up specifically for a match situation and then they kept him there because they didn't think that, you know, England were bowling particularly well to him and he was having such a huge impact on the game. And Head has said the whole time, I may not stay here. This is just this series. That is the exact right way of thinking about this. And if they need him to go back to number 5, he goes back to number 5. And if he needs to stay opening the batting, he could do that. That's how you should use your talented players.
Australia has always been that sort of a team that's good at problem solving and firefighting, and their preparation was also good for the series. But a lot of things they did on the fly, and Travis Head's promotion as opener is one of them. And I feel like
Khawaja coming back at number 5 as well. Like, he didn't look like making any runs as an opener at the end of his career, but at number 5, suddenly he looked fine again.
True. Also, you know, I feel like there was a bit of a psychological blow with respect to what Travis Head did to England, the way he smashed them. I mean, a strike rate of 87 as opener is elite. And there were innings where it was higher than 87. It was higher than runner ball as well. We've seen him kind of do that throughout the series. 300s is no joke. And he is a better batter in Australia, I feel, than any other place in the world because he's completed the set. He's got a test 100 in all of the Australian venues. And Adelaide is a sure shot success thing with Travis Head. He is South Australia's favorite current son, although some people might claim Bradman, but then the New South Welsh people. New South Welsh people will probably have an issue with that. I just feel that, you know, he's that sort of a guy who form doesn't apply to. And if he has turned up, then it's going to be really hard for you to quell, you know, Australia. However, they kept giving him width. They kept feeding him in his zones and he just continued to cash in. They kept dropping his catches for crying out loud.
I do think he broke them at Perth emotionally because I believe their plan was we're going to keep bowling short of a length, fast balls, and you guys can't handle this. And they got it wrong with Weatherall because that's what Weatherall wants. And they worked out Weatherall by the end of the series, but at that stage they hadn't. And with Head, he broke them a little bit because that was their go-to plan. I really think they thought that Australia could get rattled against high pace at them.
Yeah.
And by the end of the series, we'd have to say that bowling back of a length was absolutely pointless for England and that they should have just pitched the ball back up again. And that a lot of that goes down to Head in that one innings, right? He really did completely we did a whole video on that innings on literally all the different plans England tried. Yeah. They just lost their minds at that stage and they never truly recovered them when it came to bowling.
They kind of fell into a wormhole straight into the Wagnerverse, but in a parallel universe where the Wagnerverse is flawed, right? Like it doesn't work in that universe. But anyway, enough on Australia because we've talked about all the main performers. I do want to end this podcast on, you know, some English performances. But before that, we'll be taking a short break. You guys are watching Footmarks with Jared and Behram. Go nowhere. We'll be back in like half a minute.
Ross Taylor couldn't see at night or when the clouds were in. Eventually, he had to see an eye specialist who would fix his eyesight. In the 2 years before the change, he still averaged more than 50 in international cricket. The top level of batting talent can basically see in the dark. That is who we are talking about in our new book, The Art of Batting. Head over and order your copy today.
Welcome back to the Footmarks podcast. You are with Jared and Behram, and we are currently dissecting Australia's success and England's failure in the recently concluded Ashes series. Now, I mean, some notes on England are that they thought that Will Jacks will be a really good frontline spinner. Jacob Bethel is even on record saying that he's going to really trouble Australian batters at the SCG. Very few positives.
He got Smith out right at the end when the game was over. He finally looked like he could bowl.
Yeah, bowl or...
It is...
What was it? Bowl fast when there's nothing going on, champion? What would this be? Start
spin hard.
The ball. Yeah, spin hard when there's nothing going on, champion.
I would say that Will Jacks is probably the epitome of what went wrong for England. Hmm. They overestimated how good he could bowl. So I took a lot of flack because I've always said that Will Jacks is a very ordinary bowler.
Yeah.
Because he did so well in Pakistan, everyone's like, but whatever. And I'm like, I'm not saying he can't take wickets on occasion. But he's not a. There's a reason why England didn't keep him around after then, right? Yeah. And I got a lot of flack. And in this series, I had an email from someone who I don't even remember, but some guy was like, "Do you know what? I abused you for what you said." He's like, "I get it now, right?"
Yeah.
They started thinking he could be a frontline backup spinner, which is ridiculous.
Yeah.
And they ended with Bethel being the frontline spinner. They used Bethel at the SCG before Jacks against left-handers.
Yeah.
I think that tells you everything that you need to know. There's a little bit about footmarks there as well. But essentially, Bethel did look like the better bowler at times in this series, considering the fact that Bethel looked like a busted ass the last time we saw him bowl in a test match. So, but Will Jacks almost ended up as a specialist number eight bat. By the end of this. And that just tells you everything. If you know that spin is not going to play a big part, why are you entrusting your spin bowling to someone who fundamentally you can't trust to land the ball in the same spot consistently? Like, it doesn't make any sense. If you know it's not going to play a big part and all you need is a stock bowler, pick a fucking stock bowler.
Yeah.
Pick, you know, just say to Liam Dawson, what do you think? Five tests. Let's give it a go, right? Yeah. And they can't, you know, they couldn't do that. They were so invested in these tall off spinners, right? And we ended up with a specialist number eight bat.
which so is about invested, as shit as you can get.
So invested in tall off spinners that they didn't play the guy that they were grooming for the series this entire time. Also, whatever happened to Tom Hartley? We've all forgotten Tom Hartley.
I don't know if he's taken many wickets since then, man. I think Tom Hartley is probably an Asian specialist, is the way that they think about him. But yeah, you know.
Well, so was Tom Will Hartley. Jacks in Pakistan, but then that was Pakistan. Marcus North has taken a 6-4 at Lords versus Pakistan. It's not the team you kind of wear yourself up against, but at least in that regard, because they'll play out the good bowlers and give the wickets to the shit ones. I don't think this is Will Jacks' fault. It's not on him. But the plans were really off. And of course, some people flop hard. Ben Duckett not scoring any runs really hurts England. Crawley ends up, as their second highest run scorer, is it, in the series? Because he wasn't even that bad, I suppose. But Duckett usually gets them a lot of runs and he just could not kind of cope at all. There's like 140, 42 that he scores.
Let's just talk about Crawley first, because Crawley has ended up without 100 and averaging 27 on this tour. He's basically still done everything that we expect Zach Crawley to do.
Yep.
Right? There were, what, 3 or 4 times when we all went, whoa, look at, this is what they picked him for, right? But he gave it away. There was the Nisa one at Brisbane is the one that I remember when he goes out pulling, which sort of collapses their chance of making a big score at Brisbane. On a flat wicket, on a flattish wicket. There was a couple of other times when he gave it away when he had a chance of really crushing Australia and doing their souls, you know, and eating their souls. They actually, this is the funny thing with Australia. I think they feel more comfortable with Harry Brook than they do with Zach Crawley, right? And the reason is their best ball to Zach Crawley goes for 4 in a normal conventional cricket way, right? Yeah. And their best ball to Harry Brook, they just think that eventually, if they just keep putting the ball in the right areas to Harry Brook, he's eventually going to give them a wicket back, right?
Yeah.
And so I think they feel more confident with the, we don't understand Harry Brook. We're not actually 100% sure what we should do. But if we wait, right, he will get himself out. Well, with Crawley, I think they are a little bit like, shit, what if he does another Old Trafford type thing? And we just, there's nothing we can do to stop him and he just rolls over us. But they don't have to worry about it because he can't get there very often. And we all know he can't get there. This is a successful tour from Zach Crawley. As you said, he's the second highest run scorer.
Oh,
he was the player.
He's actually not second highest run scorer because Harry Brook does score ends. He scores runs in the last test match. So he's overtaken Crawley.
So third highest run scorer. After Root, probably the most important batter on this tour, I would have said, for England, right? This is a plus series. But again, it's the same sort of series. So by the end, Zach Crawley has still averaged about 30. He still hasn't made 100, right? And the issue isn't Zach Crawley. Because I think if I told you he was going to have this kind of series with the kind of moments he had, England would be like, great, because Duckett is going to be at the other end.
Yeah.
And they got nothing from Duckett. What's the stat that Michael Nisa faced more balls in this series than Ben Duckett did? Did that hold up to the end?
I'm not sure.
Balls faced 221. Let me find me some Nisa here. He went past Nisa in the end. Nisa got to 185. Right? So for a big period of the time, Nisa, who only batted 4 times, was ahead of him in this series. And Duckett has had one of the all-time worst series from a player of his quality, right? It really was. We expected more. That we knew there were some technical things with the extra bounce and the angled bat and they're not leaving the ball, all these things that might cause some problems. I don't think any of us thought he would make no runs.
Yeah, I mean, I had him as my highest run scorer before the series started.
Did you?
That's how strongly I felt about Ben Duckett, right?
Did I question you?
No.
Did I question you when you said that?
Here's my rationale. I thought that he's going to play the pull shot well and some balls will just go over him, right? Like, that's what I thought on bouncy tracks. But, I mean,
I actually thought what they did. Yeah, I thought they bowled really full to him and the extra bounce caught with his angle back. Yeah. Was the issue. I think specifically this is a lot of the, I don't know how many times Stark got him out, but it felt to me very Stark dependent because that the Stark's best ball early on is curving away from Duckett, right? But it's angling into the stumps. So Duckett is going to play it because he plays balls.
Yeah.
It's then going to have the extra bounce and Duckett's going to have a bit of an angle bat. And I think by the end of the series, we saw something that, to be fair to England, we hadn't seen from Duckett before. I remember seeing him when he first came back and he played Unric Nokia. I can't remember if it was Rabada or Ngidi as well, but certainly I remember Nokia was one of them. And they came around the wicket to him and they took it away off a length. And he just kept playing and missing and edging. And this was like a limited over series in South Africa. And I've been wondering ever since if another team could get to that. And no one has got to that weakness since, right? And Australia basically came up with a really good plan against him, and Duckett didn't have anything. I said for Melbourne, just send him home. He's not going to make any runs in the last test. This isn't about to change. There's an issue here, and he needs to go off and think about it. And the other issue, of course, is that Ollie Pope also, what, you know, we would have talked about this at the start. I know I talked about it on TalkSport with Goff and Hami. No one thought Ollie Pope was going to be playing by the fifth test.
Yeah.
Right?
I mean,
so you needed the other two guys to make runs, and one of them has done a Zach Crawley, and the other one's had an all-time, you know, a fail for him. And Duck has been absolutely brilliant, but it was a huge fail for him this tournament, this series. And on the back end, then Pope wasn't very good.
I mean,
once Pope didn't make runs in those first couple of games when he got starts, I was like, done. I wouldn't have even picked him by the third test. I would have batted Will Jacks at first drop from then on in.
The papacy has officially fallen, and now we've got a Barbadian in that role. At least Jacob Bethel scores some runs of 150. He actually has a very unique record. He's one of five cricketers now who have scored their first List A 100 in an ODI and their first Test 100 first class 100 in a Test match. So hopefully, you know, that is the start of something special for England.
He's got a long way to go. He's got him and Josh Tung. England fans are really excited about both of them. Josh Tung bowled in a way I've never seen him bowl before. And I was really, really excited to see him bowl like that. And I thought he was the most accurate bowler by the end of, which is absolutely wild.
And he's known to be an erratic bloke, right? Whose best ball is great. But like, other than that, he's going to spray it around. He's going to bowl those wides. But he was really on the money, and he's done.
He's got to work out his left-hander thing a little bit, obviously. So he still has some things. But I was really happy with him. At Bethel, that was a really good innings. I went back and watched it a second time, and I was like, no, I really like that innings. I still don't think Bethel understands run scoring, right? Natural batting skills, I have no issue with him. I still don't think he understands run scoring. I don't think we're looking at a guy who's going to make 200 or 300 a year for the next couple of years for England. Whether he ever gets to that level, that's the thing that England is looking to find. But I would have a lot of caution with both of those guys if I was England, just because if you think this is suddenly going to change everything, there's a lot of other weaknesses that have been exposed. I'd be more interested in if other teams can work out what Australia did to Harry Brook, which is don't worry about it. He's going to get himself out. Just keep bowling in his weak spots and let him do the madness, right? And don't worry about that. And also, I think we've got a lot of questions about Jamie Smith at the moment. Jamie Smith looked like a ghost by the end of this series. He receded in a way. There was that review that Root did when someone hit the ground. I think it might have been Nisa hit the ground. And if you're the wicketkeeper, you have to say to first slip, I don't know about this. I think we just heard a really big noise and we're going off that. Whereas he definitely hit the ground, right? And Smith didn't look like he believed it at all, but he didn't speak up. And he just receded into the background like that Homer Simpson meme going back into the bushes.
Yeah.
So that's a lot of good players that just didn't, you know, that Duckett, we talked beforehand about how I thought Brook and Smith were due a regression, right?
Yeah.
If you told me that Smith, Brook and Duckett all had these series, even I, who believed that there was a chance of this happening, would not have believed you. I wouldn't have believed that they would have got so little out of all of them. As far as impact, like Brook has averaged 40 and had almost no impact on this series. Smith has averaged 24 or whatever it is, and Duckett has averaged 24.
I mean, Jamie Smith, when he was not getting dismissed off Scotty Boland's nipbacker, he was getting dismissed by Marnus. That's how his series went, right? And he dropped catches. He wasn't really good behind the stumps in terms of, you know, DRS calls, and Snicko didn't really favor him either.
This is one where we obviously at Good Areas sometimes make fun of all this sort of stuff, but Matt Prior was saying, was it at the Gabba or I can't remember which test that Matt Prior commentated on, but he was saying he couldn't believe how quiet England were as a team when they were getting down.
Yeah.
And he kept going on about it. And look, I don't want to get into the whole Matthew Wade needs to be in the side because we need a voice in the field and everything. I think it is a bit of it was a quieter England side than we thought it was going to be. And when in Australia, you need to make your own noise because the crowd gets on top of you. Australia and India are the two places that you really need to be smart about how you talk in the field, right? Smith doesn't talk, dude. He doesn't say anything. And I don't want to put all of this on him because guys like Duckett and Pope and Crawley, I'm sorry, you have to step up in those situations and you have to provide the sound and the energy because that you start to lose control of the game when you become really quiet. But it is also a wicketkeeper's job and that is not what Smith does, right? Yeah. He does some other things brilliantly, but that is not something that he does.
Well, he wasn't a frontline wicketkeeper to begin with, right? You have to kind of factor that in as well. But I mean, he's still
not a
young.
Wicketkeeper.
Yeah, he's still young. I still have faith that he can kind of turn things around. Harry Brook is
I don't think you drop him or anything, but I think we got more of an understanding of his numbers were a little bit inflated and it was due, this was due to happen.
I mean, he was playing on some really flat decks versus India at home as well. So you have to kind of factor that in. But Harry Brook is a weird one because there is some regression. But now I'm questioning myself whether or not he will ever kind of get to those heights that everyone thought he would. Because not only does he struggle versus spin, he has other weaknesses. There's the nip backer, there's the short delivery, and then there's just the waiting thing that he's going to make a mistake on his own. So I feel like, sure, this is his first tour to Australia and he's going to tour again, but there's a big question mark next to Harry Brook for me at least now. And Joe Root is still their most important batter. And I know he scores 400 runs at an average of 44.44, scores his first ton in Australia or first ton on Australian soil with the red ball and the pink ball eventually in the series. But like, that's just two innings and they're eight failures. So it's not like he had a great series in that regard. Like the median is low, right? So I don't know.
I suppose though, if you look at it from that perspective of if they, you know, if they would have expected to bowl better and let's say catch better.
Yeah.
And for one of Smith, Duckett and who's the other one? Smith, Duckett and Brooks to have a bigger impact, right? Hmm. Then Root's had a fine series, if that's the case, right? That there's no issue with him having, you are right. It's a bit of a lopsided one. Hmm. But I think if you look at Joe Root and, you know, I was comparing, comparing Joe Root quite a lot to Sachin Tendulkar. They're guys that quite often score between 300 and, you know, 400 kind of runs in a series, right? Hmm. It's something that, you know, Joe Root goes a little bit further, but they have a very similar pattern, which is they make their hundreds and they're quite often really incredible hundreds when other people can't score them, but they're not, they don't have the big sort of series that you see from, I don't know, someone like, it looks like someone like Shubman Gill can do, right? Or Alistair Cook would be one in the old days that you, they don't seem to have those kinds of, those moments.
Yeah.
And that's fine because Root's one of the best players in the world and you can base your batting around him. Mm. Who's their second best bat in this series?
I mean, statistically, Brook, but maybe impact-wise, Crawley, right?
So that's the issue. The issue is not, if you can get 200 out of Root in Australia and he scores 400 runs at an average of what?
44.44.
In a low-scoring series, right?
He's the second-highest run scorer in the series, right? Like,
That's what I mean. There are a couple of things. I think if you would have said that Brydon Carst was going to take over 25 wickets. No, what did he end up with? 22 wickets. If you were going to say Brydon Carst takes 22 wickets and Joe Root makes 200s in Australia and you knew nothing else, wouldn't you have thought that England win this series?
Mm. I mean, that is
right?
a really...
So I don't want to be in a situation where sitting here slagging off Root. I think what he's done here is what he does a lot.
Yep.
The rest of the team had to stand up and the rest of the team did not stand up. You know, when that ball got flat, that pink ball got flat, right? Mm. It could have still been batting with Crawley and instead he was batting with fucking Jofra Archer.
Yeah. Jofra also, I mean, of course he copped all of that verbal, I don't know, sledging from Smith where he goes bowl fast when there's nothing going on, champion. But then he does bowl fast when there's something going on. He has a great test match. Then he's out injured. He should probably kind of hang up his boots in test cricket, I suppose. But then England don't really have any bowling stocks.
I don't think. If I'm England, I'm like, no, don't do that.
That's the thing.
I mean, he looked like their only, until Tung, he really looked like their only test bowler.
Yeah. Josh Tung and Jacob Bethel could be beacons of hope. Throw Harry Brook and Jamie Smith just spiritually.
Yeah, you don't throw them away.
Yeah, you don't. But there are certain people who, you know, like Brydon Carst, sure, he could be a good third seamer. Right? Not the leader of an attack. Jofra Archer might not have, you know, the fitness to continue to play test cricket. Gus Atkinson also doesn't have the fitness to play test cricket. Mark Wood should retire. There's no other way to put that. And I feel like England, they're now headed into a new phase of baz ball because it seems like they might just stick with these guys. I don't think Rob Key, Baz McCullum, and Ben Stokes, like, there will be perhaps one scapegoat, but they're not going to fire all of them, right? Like, surely. Who else do they have?
I don't know what happens now. I think that's... I've been saying this for three test matches. I'm fascinated to see what happens next, because they've also given McCullum the white ball team.
Yeah.
Right? And they've got a white ball World Cup coming up in 5 minutes' time. So, yeah, I don't know what the next step is. I'm as fascinated as anyone else. Someone is going to go, right? Rob Key is probably the easiest one to get rid of.
True.
Like, if you just look at it from a logistical point of view of, like, you know.
Also, Rob Key, I think Rob Key really hurts himself in that interview where he says that, oh, we shouldn't have sent the Ashes boys to New Zealand. Maybe schedule a couple of test matches outside the FTP in New Zealand. And then he's investigating the drinking culture. Like, I'm checking out at that point. Like, are you serious? This cannot be real.
Here's the thing. I've known Rob for a little while. We're not, like, best friends or anything. But, you know, I've known him for a little bit. And I think he's a really interesting guy. And he was a very good person to have in this role. But he lost control of what this was. And that's not his fault either. That's because McCullum became the cult of Brendan McCullum and the cult of Ben Stokes is fucking ridiculous. I don't think people outside of England realize how much the McCullum is. He, like, England won in 2015 through to 2019 when they won their World Cup and then won their 21 World Cup or whatever it was as well. That was with McCullum's template before McCullum was working for them. They looked at what Brendan McCullum was doing. Owen Morgan's talked about it over and over again, right? They looked at what New Zealand had done and they completely rejigged their cricket before McCullum came in.
Yeah.
That's how high he was rated. And then you've got Stokes. This, like, Stokes is kind of like what every alpha male English guy wants to be. Drink hard, play hard, push it, go through pain. You know, vibes, coolness, and all this sort of stuff. Like, these guys are, Ben Stokes is he's more manly than the footballers, right? And way more manly than the footballers, right? He's like a weird combination of, like, a footballer, he's, like, cool like a footballer and strong like a rugby player. He has this incredible machismo. Go and have a look at Simon Jordan on TalkSport, all the times he's ever talked about Ben Stokes. He's, you know, he's verbally masturbating over this bloke over and over again, right? And they believed it.
Yeah.
So now they're in a really weird situation that I think that Rob Key maybe has made some mistakes, but I think his biggest error was not continuing to keep control on the team, right? Now, you might say, well, you're the general manager, dude. You're the guy. So I'm sorry, you have to go. But that doesn't help solve the problem because the problem might still be the other two dudes.
Yeah.
Right?
I mean, Ben
when it comes down to it,
he is like a combination of Old Spice and a rowing machine, right? Like, that's what he is. Add a few toothpicks to that, which act as his knees. I think they need him just because they don't have any other options. Ollie Pope was their vice captain. He might never play a test for England again, right?
Brooks the next obvious leader, isn't he?
Yeah, not too comfortable with that either. Duckett had a terrible series, horrendous.
I don't know how Brook is going to captain. I still think he's an incredible talent. Just to go back on what you were saying before about him, I was the one who wasn't willing to put him in that obvious bracket that everyone else had him in.
Yeah.
And so this series has made complete sense to me because this is where I think he's more. This is what I actually think of Brook at the moment. But he could still become that other player because he hasn't reached his prime yet, right? Mm. But he played some of the dumbest cricket I've ever seen in this series, right? Some just phenomenally. He got in every fucking time, Bayram, right?
You sound like Sunil Gavaskar to me now, Jared.
Yeah. So he reminds me, he looks to me of a more talented but less smart version of Kevin Peterson at the moment, right? Is that the guy you want captaining?
I mean, I didn't want KP captaining either. That didn't go down well.
So I just think it's a real risk from that point of view. So this is the issue, right? And also, like, there's all this talk about, like, who do you bring back? Who's the county coach who has all the success? Do you know?
Peter Moores?
Yeah. Can he come back to England again? You know what I mean? So, you know, who's the international coach do you pick? You know, I mean,
Gary Stead.
Obviously.
Pick Gary Stead.
I think Gary Stead's, like, old as well. Like, right? Maybe Gary Stead's an interesting one. Mickey Arthur is probably someone you want to have a conversation with.
He's a Ravi Shastri. These guys love to party. Ravi Shastri could work.
Well, that was Monty's thing, right? Like, I'm not saying Ravi Shastri specifically, but a Ravi Shastri-like figure is another interesting one that you could bring in. That sort of Jason Gillespie type guy is another version. Gary Kirsten. Okay. I'm not saying these are bad options, but I'm not saying that I'm inspired to make these changes, right? But I think the tougher job might be if they get rid of Rob Key. Who's the Rob Key replacement?
Yeah.
Like, who's the person that you bring back in? Is it Ed Smith?
People keep citing the Boys Club, right? Everyone talks about the Boys Club, this, that, the other. But I'm just thinking about replacements. It's not like England have a lot of people in the pipeline, whether that be in an administrative role, a coaching role, or even, you know, as far as their players are concerned, because Asa Tribe is probably the best bat available. You have the Root
Asa Tribe, get him in the side right now. Where is he? I love Asa Tribe so much. Can I give you, there's one other name. There's two other names that I think are quite interesting. If they want to go down a slightly different path, whether these two people are interested in this, I'm going to assume they're not. Uh-huh. But Vikram Solanki is running Gujarat.
Okay.
And his old mate, who he might have even helped hire at Surrey, is Gareth Batty.
Ooh, and that's a mate of yours. Are we going to be working for England soon?
But if you think about it from that perspective, these are two guys that have worked together before. Right? Who had lots of success at Surrey. They've now had lots of success separate to each other as well. Half the friggin' team is from Surrey. So they're going to know a lot of these guys coming through. A lot of the talent coming through is obviously also from Surrey. If you wanted to so you keep Ben Stokes as captain and you bring in Bats as coach and you bring in Solanke as general manager or whatever. I don't think Gareth Batty wants to be the head coach of England. I could be wrong. And I don't think Vikram Solanke is going to give up the Gujarat job because I think he's just been like, I think he might have even have a better job than he had when he first started over there. I think
How about Alex Stewart? They love him at Surrey as well.
So Alex Stewart's another one. I don't want to get into the whole personal thing, but there was a moment where I think they wanted Alex Stewart for the Rob Key role before Rob Key. And there's some, you can Google it if you want, but there's some stuff in Alex Stewart's private life that made that very hard to do. And he could do the Surrey job. I think, again, those three guys would be very top of the list because they all have success. They've all played for England. They are really interesting guys in the way they think about stuff, right? And I think it would be fascinating to see how they go. Bats won't be watching this ever. But if someone tells Bats I've done this, I'll probably get an angry message on my phone. But the point being is there is that is the only thing that I would say. I mean, I really like guys like Gary Stead and Mickey Arthur. I just don't see how they fit in. Yeah. I'm not sure, you know, I wonder if you're, you know, what about like trying to poach someone like George Bailey? Mike Hessen and bringing them in, but don't bring Mike Hessen in as a coach. Bring him in as the director of cricket. Right? Something like that. But I don't know if they'll like that. Whereas I think if I went to them right now, went to England cricket and be like, what if we get the band back together? We have Alex Stewart as the overall leader. We have Vikram Solanke as the day-by-day decision maker. And we have Gareth Batty as the head coach. I wonder if they would be like, it's actually not a bad idea. On top of this, Bayram, I'll just say that the guys who used to run Surrey cricket now run the ECB.
Yeah. And don't the Roo brothers also play for Surrey, is it? Or do they play for someone else?
Everyone plays for Surrey. It doesn't matter. Name a player in county cricket who's good, right? And they're either post-playing for Surrey or pre-playing for Surrey.
How about Emilio Gay? Where's Emilio Gay at? Let me check.
Was he Durham? But my point is, once you have a good year, you end up being on Surrey's radar. That's what I mean. Yeah. So Surrey's probably... Is it North Ants? Yeah. Wherever you've made runs, right? Wherever you've made runs in cricket, you're about to play for Surrey at one stage or another because that's how it goes. Because they can recruit all of these players, right? And they know a lot more about these players than England does in some cases. You know, in Jamie Overton, not that Jamie Overton's going to play Test cricket again, but in the sort of Jamie Overton and Jamie Smith one.
Yeah.
I just think it's an interesting one to think of now with all three of those guys. I think it's probably, if I was doing it, it would maybe be more Vikram and Batty. But maybe the three-pronged approach makes more sense. You've got someone in Alex Stewart who can sort of oversee it and occasionally speak to the press, and Vikram takes the day-by-day running of it, and then Gareth Bale runs the side. As I said, I don't believe this is going to happen.
Yeah.
But there is something to be said of they have that as a potential background option if they're interested in it.
Well, that's the administrative side of it, and I suppose Jared has a suggestion. We discussed the batters. I can't think of anyone other than Emilio Gay, Asa Tribe, and the Rue brothers who's doing well.
Maybe Hamid comes in.
Yeah, Haseeb Hamid, Sibley, I don't know how he's doing.
Hamid and Sibley have been batting brilliantly in the last couple of years. I'm pretty sure I had a look
but
at that.
Jared, batting isn't even the biggest concern. Who's going to turn up as their new bowler, right? Like, I mean, they've got to probably come to a point where bionic bowlers are a thing. Give Ben Stokes a bionic knee, get Jofra Archer something as well, and now you have the, I don't know, at some point the bionic Olympics. That should be a thing. I'd pay for that.
I know we're going to go, I know that some people get upset when we say this, but they do need a replacement for Jimmy Anderson, if not in talent, in role.
Absolutely.
They do need a new ball bowler who doesn't go for a lot of runs. I think that's the thing I would look at. I don't mind their flat pitch bowling, but if they have Jofra and a Jimmy Anderson-like option available to them, Cass and Tung and, you know, and there's... I mean, Potts should be that guy, but I almost feel like... This is such a classic England thing. Do you remember when, like, they would do this all the time? They would throw a bowler in from nowhere for like a fifth test, and like then that bowler wouldn't be ready and wouldn't be in the right frame of mind, and it would go horribly wrong. And then they couldn't use that guy for the next 2 years. Like, I'm not saying they're Simon Kerrigan'd Potts here, but like, there is an element of like, you know, the Boyd rankification of Matthew Potts here, and he should be a better bowler than this. And now I wonder, you're a gutsy person, the next person who picks Potts. And there are some issues, I think, with Potts as well that that need to be talked about in general. But yeah, they need someone to be able to do the Jimmy Anderson role, which is just attack the top of off stump, not get hit for too many runs, be a consistent wicket threat. It doesn't have to be a Jimmy Anderson level wicket threat, just a consistent wicket threat, and give them some balance in this side. And at the moment, they don't have any of this.
Yeah, I mean, look, I do feel for Matthew Potts because he was taken to the cleaners and it might be over for him. I'd love to see maybe Toby Rowland-Jones coming back into the mix. Like, that's where we're at currently. There are no options. Naturalize Mohammad Abbas as a citizen. Use him because Pakistan won't. That's the best bet.
You're talking about pace bowling.
Oh, don't even go to the spinners. We should end this show. I think this is a really good note to end this show on. And thank you for watching, guys. I hope you enjoyed both this podcast and the Ashes, whatever was left of it. And I mean, we'll see you soon enough. That's all for today, guys. I'm lost for words. Goodbye.
Thank you for listening. This podcast has an ad-free version via Patreon, where there are also many other extras as well, including a Discord channel where you can chat to me directly. There is a link to the Patreon in the show notes. We are an independent podcast, so support us any way you can. Maybe give us a review, subscribe, or share on social media. All of these things help us. And when it comes to podcasts, word of mouth is always the best way of making it grow. If we had a guest on, chances are their socials are in the show notes. Please support everyone who comes on this show. I am Jared Kimber, and this is my network. But we also have hosts and co-hosts like Bahram Kazi and Estelle Vassadevan. This network is overseen by Nick McCorriston, and each episode is produced by Ishit Kaburka at Sound Potion Studio. Mukunda Bandredi, or Muku as most people will know, is the head of our YouTube channels, and he also helps out with so many other things like the podcast recordings. And there's so many other people we could thank here, but I just want to thank all the listeners and all the people who help behind the scenes that make this podcast work. If you make a lot of content like me, you are going to need help. And that is why we use Minvo.pro, a slicing and dicing tool that uses AI to conjure up incredible clips from your podcasts and meetings. If you make content, go to Minvo.pro to cut it.